Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Hey, that's my granddaughter, Claire. She's the only one in the audience. Can you believe that she's 9 years old? But that's enthusiasm. You know what enthusiasm is, right? The God within you. Thank you, Claire. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and in the unknown universe. Actually, just found out recently that science has discovered that there was a whole new and different complete universe. Now, I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. So as soon as I heard this proposition, I immediately went out and applied for the position of center. When the newcomer is in the room, I usually say, you know, you're the most important person in the room besides me, and unless the room catches fire. Just to let you know where I'm coming from. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH. That's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation, which is really a great price for free. They do this because they believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we want you to believe in what we're doing. Recovery through the 12 steps found in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not AA. Narcotics Anonymous. It's not CA. Cocaine Anonymous. This is Rum Radio and RumRadio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you've been sleeping, and if you're a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous, consider Rum Radio a wake-up call to get back into your recovery. There's a tendency in long-term recovery to get an illness known as restless laurelitis, where rest on our laurels. So it's a call to action. The magic words in recovery is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. So we said, okay, let's get back into action. Also like to acknowledge recoverytoday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the nation, so does the country, basically so does the world. We have found that most of the epidemic, and it is an epidemic of drugs and alcohol today, stem from the breakdown of the family. Correct principles were not instilled into children. The children have grown up as latchkey kids, empty lot weeds, the groups, the gangs, etc. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll always worked well for me. But it seems that I've come through the other side. A lot of the kids come in today, there's more and more of it now, less of a breakdown. You know, in the schools, they don't do anything on a spiritual level anymore. They're not getting it at home. They're just not getting it. And so Harold goes to the families, the troubled families, tries to work with them. You know, sometimes it's just putting a Band-Aid on. Sometimes it's a tourniquet. But at least the work is being done, and some get it, some don't. And, of course, the prisons, that's another phenomenon. 80%, and I just recently got this from someone else that's supposed to be in the know, 80% of all the people in our penitentiaries are there because of drug-related crimes, fueled by alcohol and drugs. 80%. You know what the cost on that is? The loss of productivity, housing these folks, the children, you know, we've got orphan children, all of that. And this is all washing through alcohols and drugs. So I like to think Rum Radio, we're like starfish throwers. A red tide comes up, and all these starfish are laying on the beach. And this fellow goes down there, and he starts flinging the starfish back in, one at a time. Another guy says, hey, what are you doing? There's millions of these things out there. You'll never get them all. He says, look, I know I'll never get them all, but I can get the ones I can get and give them back a life. And that's what we try to do here. We get the ones we can get. If you're listening, you could hear us. If you're listening, you don't hear us, you're just not ready. But this is the answer. We found the answer in the basic text. I like to use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's the template. It's the template of all 12-step programs. The original 12 steps are found in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything else that comes has derived from that understanding in one form or another. I go to a fundamental church, and I'm trying to get AA under their roof. I went right to the top of the food chain. They're not buying. They're not going with it. And, of course, I ask them the question, and they have a 12-step program. So I'll ask them, I says, well, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? Of course, they don't have an answer. Go away, kid, you bother me kind of deal. So people are going to do their own shtick. But we have found that that is an answer if it's worked properly as outlined. Anyway, okay, well, that's enough out of me. Harold, and how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for the introduction. It really is tragic going into the jails and prisons. The men are very receptive, and they're very appreciative to have someone come in, visit, teach. I highly recommend it. So it's nice to be here on the radio also, and I look forward to hearing tonight's guest. Let me mention that to our listeners, this is not a money-making proposition. The website, rumradio.org, or the radio program, Rum Radio, in fact, it costs Joseph quite a bit of money to keep it going, and I appreciate him doing that. I appreciate the opportunity to be on and be helpful to some folks. This is my way of giving back, Joseph's way of giving back. I owe my life to the program. My sobriety date is December 28th, 1987. And so I've learned many, many things in the program. Most of the things I've learned have been through passing it along. I studied the 12 steps so that I could help somebody newer in recovery study their 12 steps. And that's when things really take shape and recovery really, really begins to take hold. So I highly recommend that for folks. Let me also mention that the call-in number, 949-534-0621. Again, you can call in and participate by dialing 949-534-0621. And I'll turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Well, tonight, you know, like we do, we have some guests of note because they have better jokes, and we also do the regular Joe because who could put a yardstick on a miracle. But tonight we have kind of like a special person of note, Chris Raymer. He's one of the icons in the recovery community. He's gone out, I just talked, 20 years as a circuit speaker and going out, sponsoring, he's going to tell you, but probably a thousand guys. I would imagine that's not the case, especially with a downline where he sponsored and they sponsored other people. So he's been an impact in the recovery community. He works strictly from the book. He's a book guy, and that's what we're talking about here, folks. It's all in the book. And before we get, you there, Chris? Chris, you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Well, if you just hold on just for a second, we're going to read how it works. And this comes from the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is usually mentioned in every group or club I've ever been in. They usually read this. And I was telling Chris about that. After a couple of years in recovery, I told my sponsors, do we have to read this every time? I've heard it 1,000 times. And they said, Joseph, it's not for you. It's for the new man. It's not all about you. And the alcoholic is self-centered in the extreme. So we kind of take, self-will, self-delusion, self-serving to a new vistas of opportunity. So that's part of the program is learning about getting out of self. And that's natural man has been an enemy to God and has been so since the fall. The winter doesn't look much better. So this is a constant battle of divorcing the ego. Ego don't want to go. Ego loves it there. The ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanities of vanities, all is vanity. Pride, the disavowment of God or the need thereof. That's what I found. And this is from How It Works from the Big Book, Chapter 5, page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. But there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and that power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down guide the progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, God could and would if he were sought. All right. So, Chris, the way we do this is going to tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what keeps you to maximum service to God and your fellow creatures. So what was it like? When was the first time you had that drink of alcohol and the bells rang, the angels sang, and you heard the flapping wings?
It was just like that, as a matter of fact. I'm trying to think. January 1971 happens to be the month that our co-founder, Bill Wilson, passed away. I picked up my first drink, and it was a little bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine, and yummy, yeah. And gosh,
I remember Boone's Farm.
Oh, everybody remembers it. You do it in a big audience and talk about it, and everybody just groans at the same time. It was, it was pretty amazing stuff. But the little friend that I was having the drink with didn't care for it. He took a couple of sips and didn't like the way it tasted. I didn't particularly like the way it tasted either, but I drank enough of it to actually feel something. And I was off to the races. Well, as I've said 1,000 times from podiums, I got well that day. I was, 17 years old or so, and as miserable as I could possibly be. And all of a sudden, I understood why my dad drank, and I was off to the races.
So it rang your bell. There it is. So you felt something's different. I feel something's right. Something's right with the world.
Yep. And I've said it,
How
it's
old
like,
were you?
I think it was around 17. I forget. My twin brother and I started about the same time, and I've got an identical twin brother, and I've got two sisters that have never had a problem with any substance whatsoever. I've watched them play with it. My little sister's classic. She'll just, I'm starting to feel it, and she said, and that means no, I don't want any more. It's just like
hard to comprehend that kind of reaction. Like, what's wrong with you?
Oh, we just spent a lifetime rolling our eyes at her. Bless her heart. But my reaction is completely different, and that's just as I didn't know that at the time, for heaven's sakes. But in hindsight, looking back, when I finally understood what alcoholism was really all about, I could see it quite clearly with my whole family. My father was an alcoholic and nicest guy. He was a periodic. He would stay sober for periods of time and then twist and be pretty inebriated for quite a while, and then pull back and hold it together pretty good. But nobody else in my family, in the immediate family, was up in the family tree that we could see it. Just there's a huge genetic predisposition to this, so we know without really a shadow of a doubt. There's been enough studies done around that to choke a horse. So most of us can see that just give our little family trees a good kick and watch all them little alcoholics and addicts drop out of the top. So,
It's funny, and how it works, will say that some people are constitutionally incapable of being honest, and then we also have the term genetically predisposed to lie, but then all of a sudden people have a hard time thinking, oh, he's also genetically predisposed to be an alcoholic. Is it much of a leap? But for some it is, because they have sympathy, but there's no empathy unless you live it. But go ahead.
Yeah. And this, you know, even if with our own in our own fellowship, there's those that don't want to accept that. It's like we're letting the alcoholic off the hook when we talk about that. You know, this has been pretty well proven. There's a lot of people that want to focus on the exacerbating elements of alcoholism and drug addiction. You were referring to it earlier, you know, our home life, our crate, some of the way we're raised, some of the drama that's happened to us. I mean, oh my gosh, there's lots of extenuating circumstances that make alcoholism and drug addiction worse. But there's going to be a genetic there's going to be something that clicks with us that's going to make it virtually impossible to stop once it gets a hold of us. And unfortunately, it gets a little confusing for a lot of people, because a lot of people, like hard drinkers, Bill Wilson talks about in the big book, they can quit given sufficient reason. You know, I did a little quick therapy, and I got a new hobby and changed some friends, and I'm okay now. Wow, how cool. And I wouldn't have any problem with that, except they continue to call themselves alcoholics, and they're not.
No, I've seen that happen. Yeah, I've seen it. They can quit. You know, they do the white knuckle for a little bit, and then they go off and they make their life, you know. But usually my experience is that they get religious, or they have something that fills in the gap. Mm-hmm. But the real alcoholic cannot do that with any length of time. I've never seen any real alcoholic do it for more than like 90 days.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is progressive in nature, too, and a lot of people fail to see that. Early on, heck, I could – you know, what we don't understand sometimes, I think, is that alcohol, you know, the phenomena craving that Dr. Silkworth talks about so beautifully in the first part of our book, can be satisfied with small quantities of alcohol at certain times. Everybody wants to paint this picture that you've got to drink to a blackout to qualify to be one of us. That's just not the case. The case is, do we ever drink more than we intended, is what the book is trying to ask us. And, you know, and sometimes early on in the illness, you know, I could drink two or three beers and go to bed. It was no big deal. There were times that the next day that maybe didn't happen, but, and I drank a heck of a lot more, you know, but, that's when you're walking out of the bathroom wiping your mouth, says, God, it must have been the chicken, you know. It's like, no, it was the 12-pack you drank with the chicken. That's probably what caused it. But anyway, we started early on. We started in 17, and it turns out today, I mean, talking to the people we work with, I was pretty much of a late bloomer. Good heavens. You know, I didn't start to take a drink until I was 17. And we look at some of the young people today in our facilities where I lecture and talk. I've worked in that industry for a long, long time, about 20 years or so. And watching some of these guys, I mean, they started so unbelievably young, 11, 12 years old, you know, out there doing some of this crazy stuff. And it's just the progression just is so much faster with people, those young ones that start so early. We really got to get them while the getting's good, because they don't last as long as some of us old guys would have.
Now, would you say that most of what I see the young people coming in, I don't see as much alcohol, although it's always in the mix, but I see them coming in, their first drug of choice was drugs, you know, powders, pills. Mm-hmm. You find that or no?
Yeah, especially pills. 10 years ago, we didn't have, I mean, the facility I worked at, we'd have like one or two little heroin addicts or little opiate addicts coming off meds, and we'd kind of put them all in the same room because they hurt so bad. You know, they were miserable, and nobody wanted to room with them because they hurt. I mean, they complained all the time, and we hardly saw any for a long time. And then all of a sudden, with the advent of the prescription medication it was unbelievable to watch. I guess the facility I work now has got about 60 beds, and I bet you 40 of them are opiate addicts. It's a phenomenal watch. But again, underneath all of that, as you just mentioned, alluded to, is this garden variety alcoholic. And so one of the problems that we're seeing, especially with a lot of people, one of the tough pieces for them to swallow, if you will, especially these young people, is that, okay, I admit that I'm having problems with these opiates. I can't shoot any more heroin. But I've never had a problem with alcohol, so there's no reason that I can't go drink. And so a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of these little guys are staying away from the heroin, but they're going almost immediately and starting to drink. And that demon is exploding like a big dog. And we're losing an unbelievable amount of those young people via alcohol. It's amazing to watch that cross-addiction piece. The alcoholics, if they leave treatment, they usually relapse, sadly, around prescription medication. We're watching it by the gabillions. I mean, it's just amazing to watch. And the little drug addicts are relapsing around the alcohol. Everybody wants to try something else to treat that internal condition. You know, so if I can't get what I want, I'll try this over here. You know, it's that was the big joke in treatment always. It's like, what's your drug of choice? Yours. You know, it's like, what do you got?
What do you got?
At the end of the day, I'm
what's
not
what's available? I'm open-minded. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah. And I didn't think I ever would be because I was a purist. Because back in the days, back in Texas, a bunch of us nearly got arrested. There was a whole bunch of my friends in high school did get arrested for pot and stuff, and we kind of dodged the bullet. And I kind of made a pact with God at that time, as I would never do any illicit drugs because I was never going to go to jail. And of course I didn't until I started trying to quit drinking. And then I compromised my principles, you know. I started smoking pot or doing anything else I could do to I got to have something in me to feel better. That's the way it went with me. So I don't know.
Well, just to feel sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and that's, again, a lot of the family members don't understand. You know, they think we're drinking to escape. And I know that there are people out there that are doing that. But the truth is, what I want to do is I want to get well. I want to get comfortable in my skin. I don't want to get drunk. You have car wrecks and hurt people and do stupid stuff when you're drunk. I want to get right. And when alcohol was working for me, buddy, you couldn't touch me. I was in the food business for a lot of years. And, buddy, I was pretty phenomenal. I was a talented young man, and even impaired, I could outwork most people around me. If the stuff still worked like that, I'd probably still be drinking too, and so would everybody else listening to this show. And the
yeah.
problem is with the progression of the
illness.
If
we could get away with it, let me tell you, that would have happened.
that would have happened.
The problem is we can't.
No. And see, that's what – and you're bebopping along and you're using and drinking and it's fun and it's good, but then there's some consequences start happening and you start questioning what you're doing and you first forays into trying to moderate it and to control it, you know, and then you find you can't do it. If you do it long enough, it's just hell. I mean, that's the great line in the back of the book that Bill talks about. You're going to know loneliness like few do. You will wish for the end. And people that are
now,
not there don't understand that.
Okay, so you're in. So where are you now? Did you go to school for culinary, or how did that work?
I got an apprenticeship program actually in Houston, Texas. I was a little busboy, little cook apprentice there in the hill country where I grew up, but Central Texas. But I went to Houston. I had an executive chef at a big hotel there that had a friend of a friend kind of got me a job, and I flourished. I was pretty talented and didn't mind working hard and was, again, my experience with most alcoholics and addicts, that there's usually some major talent hidden down in there, and I kind of found mine at the time and was quite successful. All the Europeans drank in the kitchens. It was okay that we drank, and as long as you didn't, you know, you showed up on time and did what you're supposed to do. And there was a period of time I could do that without any consequences whatsoever. And then I started missing promotions and started moving around a lot, trying to stay ahead of the trouble, and that's when it got the geographical cures, don't you know? I still drive a pickup today because you just never know when you might need to move in the middle of the night. So.
Well, you always need a pickup in Texas anyway. You'll always have friends if you have a pickup truck. There's always somebody needs to move somewhere. How about the brushes with the law? Any brushes with the law? DWIs, DUIs?
Eventually. I had done a little stint in Atlanta at Omni International and had come back to Texas and ended up getting married and moving to North Texas and to be closer to my twin brother and just got Katie bar the door. I started mixing alcohol with some of those other outside issues and this was the 80s and early 80s and everybody was doing it and it was just crazy. And I got stopped one night and finally had a DWI, but it was quick and fast and good lawyer and no consequences, no jail time, no nothing and paid attention to what I was doing and just, oh my gosh, you know how I didn't get stopped a gabillion times after that. I mean, who knows, but actually, it was during that period of time was my first introduction to 12-step fellowships. And my dad had gone to 12-step stuff, in the years past. We knew he had, but, he didn't talk much about it. And he never stayed sober either. But I went to my first 12-step meeting up in North Texas trying to save a marriage. I'd promised her I wouldn't drink anymore and came home 2 weeks later. I'd had a couple of cocktails with a couple of chefs after work and she was not a happy camper and I wasn't happy either. I was compromising who I was pretty much and not enjoying it. And so I went to this fellowship and it was a nightmare going in. It was fascinating to watch everybody and what they were doing, and I realized that some of these people were actually really staying sober. I couldn't figure out how. And, if I ever say anything from the podium that makes people a little uncomfortable, it's that. I was in AA for 7 years just making meetings, and I never picked up a 30-day chip. I couldn't stay sober. Guys,
I've had
in the book
a similar experience,
to
except I didn't work the steps, but I didn't relapse. I'm a one-chip wonder, and I lived in the meetings, and the meetings kept me sober. And they'll do that. The meetings can keep you sober. So I showed a meeting one time, and I put it out, and I said, hey, how many people have not worked the steps, or how long was it before you? And there was a couple guys, 8 years, 5 years, one guy, 30 years, he never worked the steps, and they were living in the rooms. And this one guy was very interesting. He says, it was 8 years before I worked the steps. I was somewhere where I couldn't go to a meeting, and the craving came. And he said, I just barely made it back in. And as soon as I got back in, I called my sponsor and went right into the steps.
Well, he was lucky, and nobody at the time up in North Texas was working the steps to speak of. And I mean, it was meeting makers make it, and that was it. And you just go to a whole bunch of meetings. The problem is that I'm not a big one for pain, and the internal stuff starts to come back, and that obsession comes. Bill Wilson says it really clear. He's on page 24. He starts talking about, we have lost the power of choice in drink, and I don't see that in the meetings. And what I see is that you choose to stay sober every day, and you go to a meeting, and I'm so confused because I can't get it. There's a letter. I talk about it every time I speak. I'm going to be in Connecticut tomorrow night, and I promise I'm going to read this same thing. It's one little line. It's an excerpt from a letter that Bill Wilson wrote in 1942, and it's in As Bill Sees It. He says, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program. And I got a big sign on my AA. I'm on the board of directors of a little AA club, a little recovery club down there in Ingram, Texas. And we got a big sign on the wall that says that. And because I want everybody to understand, is my guys that I sponsor and visitors, I want them to understand that we in that meeting, we're there to talk about the stuff, the literature. We're there to help you. But we want to make sure that you understand how to get well if you need to get well. And that just wasn't my case 7 years in and out. Yes, I could have asked more questions. Yes, I could. I'm not blaming anybody. I'll take full responsibility. But I didn't own a big book, and I didn't have a sponsor for 7 years because I didn't know anything about that. And everybody thinks, well, that's just crazy. And I said, yeah, it sure is.
No, it's actually very common. it's more common than you'd realize.
Because, I mean, Joseph, is the mixed messages. Our own literature is, you know, just goes out of its way sometimes to confuse the newcomer. And I don't want to get in that argument, but it's just like, good gosh, you know, it's just not. Bill Wilson is so crystal clear. He's unabashedly talking about the clarity in which we work the steps quickly and have a spiritual experience, and the obsession goes away, and those 10-step promises happen. And yet, we in certain circles, in certain areas of the world, we just don't seem to want to talk about it very much. And I'm kind of a fanatic about talking. If you want to stay sober, great. Here's what we do. If you don't, then that's fine. Do whatever you want to do. But I got to sleep at night knowing that I at least presented the solution to you. And that's what happened to me after a suicide attempt in 1987. I ended up. I'm working for my twin brother up in North Texas, and I ended up back in the rooms. I heard a voice that night that said, go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm arguing with a voice because I've been in AA as far as I can see.
Didn't work.
For 7 years, and it didn't work. And I work in the industry, treatment center business. I was an administrator. I've done clerical work for treatment centers for, like I said, 21 years, I guess. And it's not a week goes by that I don't get some little knucklehead in there and finally coming out of detox, and he's madder than a hornet because he sees the 12 steps and stuff in a room, and he says, man, I thought this was going to be something else besides AA. And that's besides the 12 steps. I said, buddy, the 12 steps works. And then you sit there.
I paid a lot of money, and I want a fix. I want a different fix. Yeah, if it was
exactly
AA,
right.
I wouldn't have had to be here.
That's exactly right. I said, buddy, we're going to give you a whole bunch of other stuff besides AA, but we're going to point you towards the 12 steps. I mean, without any qualm whatsoever, because we know that people that leave treatment and get connected to a cool 12-step fellowship, they stay sober, and the people that don't. And that's just black and white as it gets. I've seen it I've done statistical work for these hospitals, and I've monitored and watched it, and that's just our experience. Anyway, this little guy, he's pissed because we've done the, we're doing the recovery stuff out of the 12 steps, and he's mad. And I said, but you talk to him, and you ask him some questions, and you find out he's never worked any steps, and he doesn't have a sponsor, and all he's done is go to a whole bunch of meetings and hadn't been able to stay sober. And, of course, we scraped it off the side of the plate. Well, he just didn't want it. But come on, guys. I mean,
it's frustrating.
Well, it is. And I'm not jamming the people that can stay sober just going to meetings. I'm not. But that's not the message Bill Wilson was talking about carrying. He talks about that middle-of-the-road solution stuff on page 25. Anything that pulls us away from the steps or that spiritual experience, as far as I'm concerned, is middle-of-the-road solution. And you're welcome to try it. And I encourage you to try it.
Well, it does. I've known people that have gone long-term sobriety, not recovery, though. They're not in recovery, but they have maintained long-term sobriety through the meetings and their own little lounge lizards. When I got to Houston, I guess 6-7 years ago, maybe longer, who knows, Post Oak, and their deal was a step a month club. And so I'm saying, why would you do that? And the people, I really want to work my steps, but my sponsor says I really need to stay on step one for a month. I said, why? Yeah. Why would you do that? And well, that's what my sponsor says, and you can't controvert. But let me get you. I got you on the right now. I have something I wrote, and I want to get your opinion on it. The concept of attraction, not promotion, also lends to a misunderstanding that you're supposed to be attracted to your sponsor. But the big book gives clear-cut direction at least three times. Find a prospect and start working on them. Big book, third edition, William G. Wilson, page 89. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You're sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have, page 96, page 18 of the big book, that the man who's making the approach has the same difficulty, that obviously knows what he's talking about. This is the whole that his whole deportment shouts at the prospect that he's the man with a real answer. This is the man you're looking for. It's the man making the approach. So three times it's telling us to go get a sponsee, but that doesn't seem to be the lay of the land. What's your take on that?
Well, we got off the page. That's the take. You know, the guy in my sponsorship letter is a guy named Don P. out of Denver. He's a wonderful man. Lots of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard him speak before. On several of his talks, you can hear it. He talks about the idea that over the period of time back in the 80s, late 70s, 80s and 90s, we got away from recovery. We started focusing on sobriety instead of recovery.
Yeah.
And that's why Bill Wilson, I mean, if you look in the big book, they use the word recovered over and over and over again. And, of course, now everybody has gotten so treatmentized, oh, you can't ever recover, which is just ridiculous. I can assure you that I'm as recovered as I'm going to get. And I could get sick again, folks. Come on, give me a break. It could all come down around me if I don't do what I'm supposed to be doing. But I've lived in a pretty wonderful life the last 26 years, and I'm in the same class as Harold there in 87. And oh, my gosh, buddies, that's the message of hope that we need to be sharing to the newcomer, that this is not just this tentative, very – very delicate thing called sobriety, that it can be rock solid to get you through those deaths of loved ones and the illnesses and the stuff that's, you know, life just does to us.
Life.
We can stay
life
sober
on life's terms,
Yeah. But this idea of giving it away, I mean, Ebby's 2 months sober when he goes and finds Bill Wilson, and then from then on, it's just they speed it up after that. It's just like, oh, my God. He's 9 days in town's hospital working the steps, and we've just, over a period of time, we slowed everything down, you know, and the old-timers will say, well, you got to give it away to keep it. And I said, buddies, my experience is you got to give it away to get it.
Yes.
Absolutely. You said it earlier when you were saying it. You said we're the most selfish, self-centered people. Bill Wilson says on 62, selfish and self-centeredness is the root of our problems. Here's what happened in 1987 after the suicide attempt. And I ended up back in Alcoholics Anonymous in these rooms, and everybody had seen me up there, and these old guys after the meeting, they asked me, this little girl had stopped me from leaving the room, and this old guy had these old readers, and he's looking over, and he says, he's got one of them beat-up books, you know what I'm talking about. It's got duct tape around it. And he's actually used it for something other than a coffee coaster. But he asked me after the meeting, he said, Chris, he said, I need to ask you a question because the big book asked me to ask you. I said, we've seen you up here in North Texas for years not staying sober. And I said, I just got to ask you. He says, are you done? You know, and we had a conversation about one day at a time and living life and what that looked like. He said, Chris, we're going to show you how to do this. If you'll come with us, we'll get you through this work at a pretty good clip, and then we're going to get you some doctors to help you with this other stuff. And would you consider doing this with us? And they qualified me that night. For the first time in 7 years, I understood that I was an alcoholic. But see, the war stories had chased me out because I hadn't gone to jail a bunch. I hadn't blacked out a whole lot. I hadn't robbed any liquor stores. I hadn't done any of the crazy stuff that we hear from podiums and in these rooms. And so I thought, well, my case is just different enough that I don't have to do this. And the truth is, when they explained the physical craving and the mental obsession, wow. I said, man, I went home excited. You're not going to believe this. I'm an alcoholic. You know, and I mean, I understood what that meant.
I just won the door prize.
Well, because I've been diagnosed, I'm on 7 medications, Joseph. I'm on 7 medications a day when I got sober. I mean, I've been diagnosed with every diagnosis in the world, and all by doctors that love me and were trying to help. But my problem was untreated alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's, long story short, we started doing the work, and that weekend they had me cleaning up the back room with them and answering the telephone with them, and for the first time it wasn't, you're the most important person here, you just sit there and be comfortable and we'll see you at the next meeting. No, they said, come on now, see those coffee cups over there, we need some help. But they kept me out of my head long enough, you know, here, go talk to that guy over there, that new little guy, go talk to him. This is a train wreck already, guys. It's not like I'm going to hurt this guy, you know. I just went over and talked to him and showed him where the bathrooms were and talked to him, you know, shared my story a little bit. But it got me out of my head, and I've never looked back. I just
Now, where the steps come in? Now, did they? Now they took you under their wing, and then they got you doing this. Now, did you get a sponsor? Did you find him? Did he find you? Was it just the group? How did that wash out with the steps?
They circled the wagons on me. They pretty much circled the wagons. I was looking at this old boy, and they said, yeah, he'd be a great sponsor for you, that old guy right over there. And they wouldn't let me leave until I talked to him. And it was a kind of a group effort. Everybody was there to help me. They'd see me early there in the meeting. They'd sit down and talk to me. And these guys qualified me the first night I'm back in, and the next day we did a third step prayer in the back room there. And they explained it. They explained the prayer for the first time, and they gave me a notebook. Said, Chris, why don't you just start working on this old four step? People's hair catches on fire. That's way too fast. I mean, guys, I've been in AA for 7 years. I mean, this is not fast at all.
Look, I'm at the speed of light now.
Oh my gosh, and that just and
I
started
know,
2 weeks
know.
Later.
I tell people you can do the first three steps sitting at a traffic light, as long as you're not in New York City. You know why? Because everybody knows that a New York minute is made up of the annoyed nanosecond. You know, when I read how it works, when we go to three propositions, A, B, and C, that's actually step 1, 2, and 3 in every meeting. We do steps 1, 2, and 3 before the meeting starts. So
Joseph,
a lot of time have to be spent on this stuff.
No, why is that so controversial? Let's just show the cat what the solution is, explain it, not scare him off with how difficult or long drawn out this is. I mean, you and I, Harold, we could all go into a meeting tonight and say, you know, Harold's working on a four step, and the entire room will groan. Oh, that was so hard.
Oh, poor guy. Wait a minute. You need
poor
a cup of
guy.
Coffee?
That's just ridiculous when you see what it's about and you've got somebody kind of staying on you. My four step took me a few days to do. You know, I didn't write an all-American novel, but I got the big pieces out and I got some clarity around it. And
right.
I got the step. And anyway, I'm starting making the amends. They're showing me the disciplines of 10 and 11. And we're talking prayer and meditation without any hesitation whatsoever. These guys understood that this is unapologetically about God and my own personal spiritual experience. And they talked to me about that. And within about, 4 months, I'm sponsoring a little guy. And it's been a rocket ride ever since.
Sponsoring is the key. Now, in the 12 and 12, and, you know, some folks just don't like the 12 and 12. I don't get it. Page 165 says, we know so little, more shall be disclosed. So let's get rid of the 12 and 12 so we can know even less. But they don't like the 12 and 12. I said, no, it's okay. You could use the 12 and 12. Don't be afraid. It's just a compilation of experience over an extended period of time. Come on.
Yeah.
And it says in step 5, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship. Excuse me. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what I hear is not only do I have to speak a fifth step, I have to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor hears a fifth step. So until you've heard a fifth step, you're circling the field waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. So on the Facebook deal, you know, some of the alcoholics said, no, it should be step 6 and 7 before they could sponsor. You know what I said? Okay, let's get them started, though.
Yep.
Let's get them in the mix. Let's get them in the trenches.
I get emails all the time, Joseph, but people want to say, well, how long should it take? Give me an outline. I can't really do that because I think there's a certain amount of intuitiveness here. I can get some of these little young adults that I get to work with, these little college-age kids, they're like sharp as whips, you know, and I mean, we can mow through this stuff pretty fast, and some, you know, they're again, depending on their detoxes, for heaven's sakes. You know, I may, we may have to go a little slower, but the idea is to get them through at a pretty good clip. And if I don't have time to work with them, you know, then maybe I need to pass. But it's not like I don't take people on to raise as sponsees. They're not my product. They're not my they're my little protege. I'm there to guide them through this work. And then I'm going to hold them a little accountable after that, and I'm going to ensure that they go out and find them some little cats to work with, because that's the miracle. That's the miracle. And nobody back in the day, and when we first got the big book, was taking longer than 30 days to work the steps. Nobody was taking longer than a few weeks to do it. And we've gotten so smart now that we want to go, you know, take a year to do it. It's breathtaking.
Yeah, I discern things. When I see things that just doesn't make sense, and I try to discover why the year. Matter of fact, in the AA pamphlet on sponsorship, it suggests a year before you sponsor someone. And they go, well, who the hell came up with that? And I think the reason they love me. That's I did. I'm like you. I'm one of their favorites in the neighborhood. And I said, that makes no sense at all. And I think the reason why is because it's sort of like a convoluted thinking that the first year of sobriety, we're not supposed to make any sudden changes or moves. You don't change your job, you don't get married, buy yourself a house, move to Constantinople, you know, that kind of stuff for the year. So in that year, you know, no illicit romances for the first year. You know, all of that has nothing to do with recovery, but we got this whole litany, you know, like 90 meetings in 90 days and think to drink through and all this stuff they come up with, all these little sound bites. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is not in the big book. It's not, you know, so I have on the website, I have the surrender. Do you remember the surrender?
Mm-hmm.
The surrender was done early on. Dr. Bob had come up with it in 1937. It was one of the, when they went to the hospital to get you, and this is before the term sponsor became abroad. So a sponsor was someone who would go to the hospital and find the prospect, which is a sales term, by the way. So they're going to go find the prospect because they don't really belong until they've gotten some guy. You know, because they want to be part of this thing, and before they can really be part of this, they got to go get somebody. Wow.
Absolutely.
So they go to the hospital, and they find the prospect. They find this guy 6 days. He's got 6 days. To get them, there's one of the stories in the traditions, an old-timer goes to the hospital. This old-timer probably had 2 years. He was an old-timer at the time, and he finds the Irish guy and all that. And what they would do is that they would try to work with him, you know, give him you had 6 days, but you would try to do it in a couple days. And then if the guy was interested and he said, he was desperate enough, before he left the hospital, he had to get on his knees and admit the first three steps, basically. It was the beginning of the first three steps. He had to do that before he could go to a meeting. And if he missed it at the hospital, he had to do it at the Williams house or at the Oxford group upstairs. And then you could go to the meeting, and then this fellow who just stood around and introduced you around eventually became what we call a sponsor today. But he might even have paid your bill. And then the restitution steps and the character flaw steps were done in a matter of days after that. So this whole process was probably a week or two, and the guy was back at the hospital. Same hospital he got out of. Now he knows the routine. He's got an answer. He's excited. He's got the word passion and enthusiasm. And he's out there trying to get connected because he knows his survival depends on his ability to get the next sufferer.
Yep. We could. Our success rates would be through the ceiling if we did that. When they tabulated those success rates in 1955, that's exactly what they were doing. And that's, from somebody that's worked in the treatment center field for all these years, watching the thousands of people in our fellowships, our various fellowships, coming into these H&I meetings and looking for little guys that they could help. I mean, I can't tell you how many comments I've had from our patients at the various hospitals where I've been associated, who just said, oh my gosh, that kid finally explained, I think I understand what y'all are trying to tell me now. And it's just, and all the pieces put together by some little knucklehead that took an evening off to come to the hospital and talk. Why?
Yeah.
That's just, it makes you weepy. Harry Tebow, the guy that Bill Wilson's shrink while he was while Bill Wilson was writing the 12 and 12, this guy had did some great writings. But one of the things he said in there, and I'll paraphrase because I don't have the quote right in front of me, he says, you could hit 1,000 bottoms, but unless you surrender at one of those bottoms, you're just going to keep hitting bottoms. See,
yeah, you're going to lower that bottom for the next time.
It's just more and more. Listen, I tried to quit early on. You know, when I tried to quit for my first wife, bless her heart, in the early 80s, I meant it when I said I was going to stop drinking. I just didn't have the power to pull it off. And it's just, my bottom was not all the drama that I heard about or experienced. My drama, my bottom was hearing what the first step really meant and understanding it. And then these guys getting me focused on the light, not to just swim in the despair, but buddy, come on, let's get cranking here and get well so we can go help the endless waves of poor sots coming towards us. And that's the,
you know, I check Google. I do a lot of, you know, 1,000 years hence, the anthropologists will have concluded that as a society, they all commune with an all-knowing God named Google. And Google has 140 million alcoholics in the world. I don't know how Google did it, if they went one at a time, hi, are you an alcoholic? But 140 million later, that's the estimate of drunks in the world. 2 million in the rooms, 2,100,000, 2010 census, how accurate, who knows, but so the field is ripe and ready to go. You know, the harvest is just huge until we mobilize in a direction what they used to do. See, a lot of people have a hard time with you because they think you've got a new message. You don't have a new idea. This is not a new idea. This is an old idea that just looks new.
Yeah. Yeah, we just got to get it back. And maybe my passion comes from, and again, my perspective. I mean, I almost died sitting in the rooms, not hearing the message. But then again, watching in the treatment centers, watching the people turn away. Why are you turning away from the fellowship that saved my life, that saved our lives, that all of us on this line right now?
Yeah.
Why are you turning away from it? And they're turning away because it's been horribly misrepresented. Horribly misrepresented.
Yes.
What we're going to start to see right now, just on a side note, this Affordable Care Act has just come down the pike. We're seeing pieces of it already come through our treatment centers as of last year. Some of the provisions in there, but what we're fixing to see is a conservative estimate is 46 million newly insured people coming into existence here, eligible for coverage. A lot of these people are alcoholics and addicts that are going to need help. We don't think that this is particularly going to pay for expensive places, but it will pay for some outpatient, will pay for some extended care, and I guarantee you what will happen is these people are going to end up needing to come someplace, and they're going to be coming to our rooms. And I got to tell you, from a kid that was there in the 80s when the treatment centers were grinding them out before, we weren't ready. You know, when that van pulled up with 20 patients in it and come into our AA meetings, and we stood around looking like, what the heck is that? We weren't ready
now
for that
influx.
Now
what do we do with them?
And now what do we do with them? And there was lots of writings that perhaps they didn't get the kind of sponsorship that we got. And so we're going to see a tidal wave, we believe, of these folks coming into our fellowship. They're not going to maybe be able to afford, you know, really good, really
long-term
treatment.
Yeah, they're not going to do the country club stuff, but they're going to get at least detox. They're going to get a primer, and then they're going to be able to be directed. So my deal is that why don't we make hearing a fifth step a rite of passage where you got to go out, you know, and they're not just going to be coming in the rooms, which is great, but you go get them. So if there's not enough in the room to go get them, then you're going to have to go somewhere else. You're going to have to go to the missions. You're going to have to go to the halfway houses, three-quarter houses. And I'm sure the rehabs will be more than happy to bring AA meetings or maybe AA sponsors or temporary sponsors. It's not going to cost them anything. And now they can make the transition back into the rooms.
Yeah, they'll not only let them, they encourage it. They're looking for them even as we speak. And the problem is we don't have enough people to do it. Again, the AA trench is full of a few people that really want to do help, and they're doing the work. There's a lot of people sitting on the periphery. And I'm not taking a shot at anybody, but I'm just saying we don't have enough help. We don't have enough people having done the work themselves, ready to get out there and try to help some of these folks get connected. In certain parts of the country, it's like Mecca. There's just great recovery in certain parts of the country. In certain parts of the country, it's kind of downright scary. It just there's none of that hospital and institution work they're begging for help. I'm going to repeat it, Joseph, in follow-up calls with alumni, the people that have gotten connected with good sponsorship and are in meetings, you know, kicking butt, they're staying sober. We come from great treatment centers. But treatment centers don't allow us to recover. Treatment centers get us good and dried out, give us some information and focus, get our attention focused on the things we need to be doing. If we don't get connected to long-term recovery in our fellowships, we don't stay sober. Not if you're the real McCoy, you won't stay sober. I've seen it forever. So
When I see people going into the rehabs, a lot of times, and what's happening is there's a 200-man waiting list to do 12-step calls here in Houston. And the reason why is because the rehabs does the marketing, so people say, let's see, should I go to AA or can I buy my way into recovery through a rehab?
Yeah.
And so now I found an easier, softer way. So we don't get the 12-step calls we used to have. I said, okay, great. They're spending the money to gather the sheep. Let's go where they've already been gathered.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's and like I said, having talked to thousands of patients that absolutely loved those meetings. You know how it was? When I got sober, the guy that was chairing the first meeting when I went back in 87 after that suicide attempt, the guy that was chairing the meeting had 10 years of sobriety, and he's still alive today. And he's a wonderful man. I didn't want to hear anything he had to say. There was a guy right across from me that picked up a 60-day chip, and I can't take my little eyes off of him because I want to, you know, this guy, other guy's a liar, obviously. Nobody stays sober 10 years. But 60 days? You know, I want to go talk to this guy right here.
Possible. That's in the realm of possibility. Maybe.
That's a doable.
Maybe.
and that's the deals. My shtick out there when I speak from the public, we got way too many people out there telling people what they can't do. You can't sponsor till you're a year. You can't chair a meeting till you're this long. You can't take an H&I until you're 6 months. You can't do this until you're this. Guys, we gotta really take a look at what we're doing. Because we've got to give these folks an opportunity to be helpful, and then they'll understand the miracle of what Bill Wilson's saying. He says it on bottom page 129, in those first days of convalescence, nothing will help you like working with another drunk.
The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. That's sort of the mantra, but then you can't give away something you don't have. So what I propose, and nobody ever listens, is that instead of asking how much time the guy's got, ask him what step he's on, and if he can't,
absolutely.
If he hasn't done at least a step five, he can't chair a meeting.
Gotcha. No problem. And then the sponsor needs to be, you know, poked. Buddy, why are we dragging our feet here? Let's get this thing done. My experience is if I give this little guy a week to do a fifth step, he'll do it in a week. If I give him 6 months, he'll take 6 months. So I mean, we got to put some emphasis on here. Where's the urgency?
Yeah, I give my sponsees a couple days. That's it. Okay, let's see. Tuesday, I need you by Friday. Oh, I can't do it Friday. I got to control the world by Friday. We got to do Friday. All right, I'll tell you what. Saturday.
Oh, too good, Joseph.
You're
close enough in Houston.
If you give them 6 months, they're going to do it on the last day. If you give them 24 hours, they'll do it on the last day. So what's the difference? But just get them going.
Yeah.
I do a little different deal. I cut it down a little bit with the fourth step. Part of the problem with the fourth step is that we've made a Godzilla out of it. People fear it.
Yep.
They don't know what to do with it. It just says it has to be written. Thoroughness will pay off handsomely. So my deal is this should timely rob thoroughness and thoroughness rob timely. I think timely is really the key, because when you write a fourth step, half of the stuff's not going to come up until later because you don't even think you did anything wrong yet. So let's get it in there. Yeah, I put a funnel in their mouth. I shoved the 12 steps down their throat. Some of them it takes. But the nice news is that if it didn't take and they go out again, well, I've ruined their drinking career, because they're never going to drink again with impunity once they've worked all 12 steps. I've ruined it.
Yeah.
Their careers go, and we leave the light on. So now they know their way back. So the key really is get them through the steps in a timely manner. The thoroughness, okay. You got to take each guy as it comes and some a little bit more thorough, but you don't have to waste a lot of time on a lot of the stuff. It's just like it's almost intuitive once you get started.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Downstream next year, the year after, come on. I've got this 80. I've joked about it from 1,000 podiums. I've got this 84-page four-step guide somewhere in my bookcase here. 84-page four-step guide. Now, come on, buddy. I'm going to break down and do it 1 year just to say I did. You know, but if you want to do something like that, then, you know, there's a cool form, different ways to do it. You know, you could extend this column and do this and do that. Initially going in the door, just like Bill and Dr. Bob did. Dr. Bob worked with over 5,000 drunks in his 15 years of life. He didn't sponsor them like we're sponsoring them, sitting down, and doing a 10-hour fifth step. I mean, come on.
No, well, they had 6 days. That was the number of folks that went through the hospital. I did a post on Sister Ignatia. Cute. It's the first chipmunk started with a habit, Sister Ignatia. There's cute stuff in there. She gave out the Sacred Heart of Jesus medallion. I got the story out there. And what you would do, she'd give you the medallion. And I've seen different medallions. Some of the cloth and some are metal. And I think what she did was she gave you what you could scrounge up.
Yep.
And she gave you the coin. And this is the promise that if you're thinking about drinking, you had to give it back. Not drinking. If you were thinking about drinking, you had to give it back. Okay,
wow.
Sister.
That's I've seen a couple of examples of those things too, and they're amazing. I love our history. I mean, it's just one generation away from lobotomies and death. I mean, good gosh, guys, we've come a million miles, and the greatest gift were those 12 steps. I do feel some real responsibility to try to stick to the literature and maybe I get a little overzealous
sometimes. What works, and that's the shame about it, is that we've taken, you know, Bill was afraid of that. He says, you know, we're going to have to give it to them, and if they ruin it, they just ruin it. But, you know, we could just pray about that they're going to figure it out. And what I've seen is that for the most part, I believe, I hope that there's a turn going on. And you are like my sponsor used to say it to me, but you really are the point of the sword. You know, Houston was point of the sword, getting back to a basics understanding of the big book, getting through sponsorship and the steps, and getting away from the meeting as recovery and not the steps. I was at Primary Purpose here, and I'm sitting in the back, and these two young fellas in front of me, right? It had to be right in front of me, and this one guy decided to have this guy as his sponsor. He must have said something that resonated with him, and he said, oh, okay, they were exchanging information. He turns around to the guy and he goes, what do you think I should start with? And his new sponsor turned around and said, you know, when going to a lot of meetings, that really helped me in the beginning. and had to be right in front of me, right? Excuse me, guys. So I carried the Rum Radio cards. I says, look, we have the information on sponsorship and through the big book. Like, I think both of you would be really get a lot of benefit out of this. Had to be right in front of me. Yeah, I went to a lot of meetings, and but that's the lay of the land. And the Grapevine had in December, I think it was, don't drink and go to meetings. Some of the old timers on Facebook went nuts. I said, wait a minute. I said, the Grapevine is our monthly meeting in print. They're not going to go. This is where the fellowship is at. They're reporting to the state of the fellowship. They're not innovative. This is what's going on right now. This is the state of the state.
Yeah. I have to be optimistic, and I won't even mention that the Grapevine, but I have to be optimistic with the I've got friends in New York at GSO, and big deal this conference to change some of the written stuff. They're a big push to get the circle triangle put back in the front of the books, where a lot of us stayed in balance. You know, I mean, we've got to be in all three parts. We've got to be in recovery, the unity, and service and sponsorship. And I don't know anybody that's ever, you know, if you're in all three parts, I mean, no matter what life's throwing at you, you're staying sober. And, you know, people take what I say sometimes out of context. And I've never not, I love meetings to this day. It's part of of our three legacies, and so we got to go to meetings. I'm just saying, I just think we sound like a cult when we tell somebody that you got to be in a meeting every day if you want to stay sober. And that's just I have a tough time swallowing that.
You know what I've discerned on that? It's we start meetings usually with a prayer that's called an invocation. All recovery meetings, regardless of the topic spin, are gratitude meetings. And an attitude of gratitude is a prayer unto God. And we end the meeting with a prayer that's called a benediction, thanking for the Spirit to have been with us. So as much as the folks don't like it, I mean, we've had. So what you do, what do you get in a meeting? You're going to get a spiritual bump. And you're going to get a spiritual bump. And you're going to get a spiritual bump. So now the thing is when am I going to get my next spiritual bump? Not when I'm going to work the steps. Not when am I going to get a sponsee. When am I going to get my next spiritual bump? And so I got to go to a meeting tomorrow and a meeting the next day. I might do two meetings today. Well, I have sponsees. I say, how come you haven't sponsored anybody? I don't have the time. How many meetings have you gone to this week? Well, I've gone to six, but I don't have the time to sponsor anybody.
Yeah. There's the grind. I just think we can do it all. I think we can do all. You know, it's not an option. I mean, it's the greatest joy in the world to sit down with somebody and watch the little light come on. And they go,
You
mean I can actually recover? That's the juice. And unless you feel that, you're not going to stay. You're going to get pulled a thousand directions and get bored with what we're doing in the meetings and leave, and we can't afford to lose you. We can't afford to lose anyone.
If you've been just counting on the meetings, eventually what's going to happen is one of the fellows in there that you don't particularly care for is going to share the same thing he shared for the last 8,000 times, and you'd prefer to put a gallon of gas over you and light yourself on fire instead of listening to him what he had to say again. And that's when you know you've been to too many meetings.
Oh, man. That's why, you know, everybody said we build the fellowship we crave. We had to start our meetings up in the Hill Country. We had to start as a little Big Book Thumper group, and it turned into a little Big Book Thumper club with, you know, Cocaine Anonymous and Drug Addicts Anonymous meet there, too. And but everybody's literature-based. You got to be a literature-based meeting to meet there. It's pretty cool. And there's plenty of other meetings if you just want to go talk about your day. But you know, if you want to study the literature, we've got them there in Ingram, Texas. So it's pretty cool.
You know, I brought the big book, I guess you call it a primer, you know, the book that asks a question and then the answer is in the next line of the big book, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with that, right? The primary's got it in Austin, and they have it in San Antonio and I think Dallas, right? Isn't that, you guys are part of that? I think. I bought it from Austin and had it for a while, gave it to somebody at primary here in Houston, explained it all to them, that this was a primary deal and there would be a nice synergy around it. They started it, took it to group conscience, and voted it out. And I made this impassioned speech to try to keep it. Lady even applauded, but she probably didn't know who I was while she applauded. And they turned it down. They wanted another discussion meeting instead of another literature meeting.
Yep. In some areas, that's just what happened. It's heartbreaking because there's just even if you didn't want to use a workbook and you just had another format where we could study the literature, it would be cool too. You know, it's some people just don't want to do that. It's all about sharing, and that's great unless you happen to be an alcoholic of my variety, and then you're going to need this thing called a spiritual experience. And I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. I still think we're gaining
on
it, Joseph.
You know, look, you're doing the right thing. You know, we're trying with the website. So I think this energy is starting to move. I could see some of the old-timers on the websites, on the Facebook, and they stick to the program, and they're big book thumpers. And so I see there's an energy going about. I really do. I believe that the pendulum is swinging back. I think you've put in so much energy, and other people have put in so much energy. I think that AA is starting to come around. I pray that's the case. I think we're going to see that. If you people are going to love you, like I told you earlier. People are going to love you when you're dead.
Yeah. It's sad sometimes. Like I said, it's frustrating. I don't want to. I love everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous truly. And if you've been around for years and years and years, even if you don't work the steps, I mean, I thank you for your service. And it's an honor to know you. But my heart goes out to the little thumpers. My heart goes out to the little cats that haven't been able to stay sober, and all of a sudden they finally finish the fourth step and realize they've been a victim all their life, self-imposed crises, and they get excited about working with some drunks. And I don't know, brother. How cool to be a part of that. And yes, it just takes some courage to stand for something sometimes. Sometimes you got to take a stand, and that's what we do.
That's what Zig Ziglar said. If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Chris, do you have anything that you wanted to get out, any your rehab or anything like that?
No, I'm absolutely honored that you asked me. We've been trying to put this together forever, it seems like, and my schedule has been so nuts, and I haven't been able to actually do it. I would love to do it again sometime to sit and discuss some specific other stuff. I'm a history buff and a student of this whole thing. On the firing line, those of us that work in the industry, the counselors that are maybe listening out there, and the therapists, and you know the people that work in the treatment field, we see it every day. The absolute just the horror of this crazy illness, and it's
waste.
So
it's just such a waste.
Oh.
It's not necessary. That's what makes it a waste.
Absolutely not necessary. It's our prayer that if we could all just kind of get on the same page. I know there's different strokes for different folks, as they say, and you know some folks need different things, and I'm okay with that as long as it doesn't dilute our message.
Bill W. said in his last speech was that AA will change. AA must change, but the message is not going to change. The delivery of the message will change.
Just think back when the fourth edition was published. When it started talking in the forewords about the computer, you know, computer to computer. I forget the exact way it did it, but talking about the computer age and how much. I mean, I look at it now. I mean, it was last year, one of the little guys I sponsored was sitting in a meeting, and he had his little phone out, and it was, we have a literature-based meeting, and everybody's got their books open, and he's got his phone, and I'm thinking he's texting, and I go over there and thump the back of his head, and he's got the little book on his little iPhone, you know, he's reading right along with us, you know. I'm so technically stupid, I didn't realize that. I mean, there's so much cool stuff out there for people to – I mean, don't believe us. I mean, go pick up the archives. Look at some of the wonderful history sites we have out there and realize that those old guys back there had the same illness that we have today, and that they –
identical.
They worked the steps quicker, identical, and they just had a quicker, more efficient way of dealing with it than kind of how we've gotten into. And so,
doing it, yeah, where we've ended up. I tell people, say, well, it was different. I said, let me tell you something, Chief. People haven't changed in about 4,000 years. It wasn't really different 70 years ago.
No.
So this is the same deal, you know.
That's my problem with some of the meetings that we do. We've got special interest meetings, special population meetings, and this, that, and that. I don't have gay alcoholism, and I'm not trying to stir up a hornet's nest. I don't have young adult alcoholism. I don't have male alcoholism. I've just got the same sitting in a room with all different walks of life, understanding that with a spiritual experience we can overcome this damnable disease. I mean, it's as powerful as it gets. And I'm not an alcoholic because of my drama. I'm blind in one eye. I'm not an alcoholic because I'm blind in one eye. I'm an alcoholic because I'm an alcoholic, and there you go. I mean, I can't help but get excited about the prospects. I really truly do, brothers.
That's what makes you effective, Chris, is your passion and your enthusiasm. See, and a lot of folks, they don't get that. They just, they see that as a grand deal. I get it all the time. Oh, this guy, he's got no humility. I hear that stuff all the time. I'm just passionate about it. You know, this is the right message. This is correct. Oh, by the way, I want to say, I have some history on the website, too, some things that are not generally gone abroad. So if you ever want to get into it, some stuff that I've discerned from other archives and put stuff together. From Dick B, you know, things like that. The Amazing Grace, stuff like that. I think you'd find it kind of – I love AA history. I mean, it's just – you know, Sister Ignatia's been put forward to become a saint. Requiring 3 – miracles while she was alive, verifiable miracles, and 1 miracle after she died. So what I did for a while is I resurrected her likeness of image, and I was sending it around the world because sometimes even a saint needs a leg up.
That would be the coolest. That would be the coolest.
Well, no, you know, I guess in time it'll come abroad. So thank you so much for your time and your energy. That was great. I really enjoyed this time we've had together. Harold, did you have anything?
Well, I've enjoyed it also, and I think our focus is really important, and I hope a lot of people are helped knowing that we have to reach out to one another and give back in order to keep it.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on, Chris.
Honored. Thank you so much, sir. Joseph, be good.
Thank you, Chris, and you too. Be careful on your travels around the world. Now,
like
another lone eagle.
I'll see you soon.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Bye, sir. Bye, sir.
Bye. And like usual, I'd like to say that this is Rum Radio. If you're looking for sponsorship information, this is probably the most comprehensive sponsorship information you're going to find anywhere. This is experience over years and years have been compiled in a way that's readily accessible and available for no charge, a point and a click, and you get information that's been sifted through quite a few people from all over the world. It's very effective stuff, and I try to make it humorous and spiritual. So take a look. You'll like it if you see it. The only people who don't like Rum Radio are people who won't look at it. So thanks, Harold. And remember...
You're welcome.
And remember, like usual, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.